Good morning. It's June 30th, 2011. The interviewers are Laura Bacon, Jonathan Friedman, and Michael Scharf. And we're here today with Frances Johnson Morris. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, my name is Frances Johnson Morris. I'm the chairperson of the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission, currently.
Wonderful. And would you like to explain some of your past positions and what led you to this position?
Oh, yes. Before coming here, I had experiences with several other positions, portfolios in our government. If you want me to go as far back as when I was at the judiciary, I served as a circuit judge. After that, I was elevated to a transitional chief justice. That was during 1997, right after the first war that brought Charles Taylor to power. I was chief justice at that time, and I happened to have inducted him. I was honored to have inducted the president for the first time in my life. After that experience, I temporarily went into private practice as I was replaced on the bench right after his inauguration. I went to private practice, practicing law for about 4 years. Then the Catholic Church in Liberia called me to serve as the national director of the human rights arm, the Justice and Peace Commission of the Catholic Church. So I served there for about 2 years or so. And finally, the cessation of hostilities after that, and the peace process, the war laws and other stakeholders were brought together in Accra, where they agreed that, you know, they would cease fire and they would, you know, hold elections, you know, and then just stop the bloodshed at that point, actually. And that happened, and when it came, they decided that they wanted to reconstitute the National Elections Commission, because everyone was suspicious of the other, and, you know, and had they had elections in 2003, they didn't think that there would have been fair play, and Mr. Taylor would have won elections again, you know. So they wanted the commission to be reconstituted. So that's how I got on the National Elections Commission as chairperson. I was recommended actually by civil society, human rights and pro-democracy groups. The recommendations were made to the then chairman of the National Transitional Government, Charles Judah Bryant. So there were so many names that have been, I have been recommended on the again for the Supreme Court as well as the National Elections Commission. So the chairman, Charles Judah Bryant, decided that you've already been to the Supreme Court before, so we think you need to go to the National Elections Commission. With the integrity that you bring, you know, the character, we need somebody like you at the National Elections Commission. So I said, okay, you know, my preference would have been the Supreme Court because I'm a lawyer and that's where I felt more comfortable. But he said, no, go to the National Elections Commission. So that's how I got the National Elections Commission as chair. The experience there, you know, conducting a post-war election, it is not an easy task. You know, everyone, you know, they saw this as maybe an opportunity to participate, because some people felt that they had been marginalized and excluded for so long, and so this was a new dispensation. They wanted to, you know, everyone was eager to go to the process, and so almost everybody were forming political parties. At one point, somebody asked, when are we going to stop the registration of political parties? I said, well, you know, our constitution does not limit the number of political parties that may be formed. And as far as I'm concerned, if every household wanted to form a political party, I don't have a problem with that. Let the Liberian people decide. The Liberian people will be the ones to decide. And so we had, you know, 22 parties registered, 22 parties, but 22 presidential candidates in those elections, 22. And so, you know, the international community, Unreal that was here, the US, the EU, the AU, African Union, all of those people were here, as guarantors of the peace, and they contributed immensely. So the support for that election, the bulk of it, in fact, almost 90% of it, came from the international community. Our government supported the staff of the commission, gave logistics, fuel, distributed vehicles, but the international community supported the thing. And so in order to bring, for people to be comfortable with the process, there are a lot of reforms that we had to undertake before going to elections. If I may backtrack a little, we had to do a lot of reform. We had to change the electoral law at the time. We had to even go to the extent of suspending some constitutional provisions, which we have excluded people, because we have a constitutional provision of Article 52C, which bars anyone from contesting the presidency who has not lived in the country 10 years before elections. So we had to suspend that, so to give everybody an opportunity, so that nobody would be excluded, to give anybody cause to go back into the bushes to fight. We did that. So we had to suspend those provisions. We also had to suspend, since there were no census had not been taken for about 20 years or so before we went to the 2005 elections. So the electoral districts that were existing then, we had to say, we have to go back and use these electoral districts, maybe not the same ones, because the previous 64 seats we felt were not done in accordance with the demarcation of those 64 seats at the time were politically motivated, and they did not exactly reflect the actual picture. The representation was not in accordance with the situation on the ground. Some people had lesser inhabitants, but they got higher number of seats. And so we felt that if we are to conduct free and fair elections, we cannot follow these electoral district and the constituencies that were done some years back under a military regime, so to speak, So we needed to re-demarcate electoral districts to reflect the actual representation on the ground. So those were some of the reforms that we did, and there were a lot of, other things that we had to do to ensure free and fair elections. And a lot of international people came. We had to talk about the electoral system that would be used for the 2005 elections. Some of our stakeholders felt that we should use the PR, the proportional representation system. And our view at that time was that, the last elections held in Liberia in 1997 used the PR system. And we know the kind of abuses. People who had no connection to some of the areas were sent there to represent people. There was no relationship. Because the PR system, what it does is that you do not elect your person per se. You elect a party, a political party. And the political party brings a listing. If they have a listing, depending on the position of a candidate, they could say, okay, this person go over there, that other person. So we said we rejected the PR system. We said we wanted to do our majoritarian system of election, where people will physically vote for the person they want, and not just vote for a political party. You must vote for somebody who knows you, who you know, and who can identify with you, and not leave it to the discretion of the political party leaders to decide who will represent. So we rejected that. And so we went with the majoritarian election system, which calls for absolute majority, right now, as we speak, there are debates going on. We will be going to a referendum in on August 23 to decide whether to keep the absolute majority for all of the elected positions or just for the presidency. So, but at that time, that's what we had. We had to use it for everything. So, we went through a system that was, you know, I mean, full of excitement. At the same time, there were issues, there were problems, but those were exciting times because Liberia had been at war for nearly 14 years. And to have an opportunity to elect leaders that, you know, would take them out of the mode of belligerence and violence, it was very good. People had suffered long enough, so they wanted to break. So they went to election, you know, and I think the elections were, people describe the elections as the best elections in Liberia's history. You know, because other elections I had problems, and, you know, but that those elections, everyone, there was plural participation. There was no denial of anybody, you know, everybody was free to campaign, and it was just very, very, you know, interesting and exciting, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, after elections, there will be challenges. There will be, you know, people who are dissatisfied. People will say, well, you know, I think I won these elections, and I don't think I was treated fairly. So we had our issues. There was, you know, after the first round of elections, the 22 candidates went to elections. We had the first round. Ambassador George Weah, the former soccer star, he led in the first round. But he had 28%. The incumbent president right now had, about 90% or so. You know, I can't recall the figures now. But, so the two of them qualified to go to a runoff election. So, because our law says, if nobody gets 50% plus one of the valid votes cast, then there has to be a runoff for the two who have obtained the highest numbers of votes in the first round. So President Sirleaf now and Ambassador George Weah qualified to go to the second round. And after the second round, President Sirleaf won, you know. And so Ambassador Weah and his party felt, well, you know, these elections, we have won the election, they cheated us, and you know, blah, blah, blah. They took their case, they brought the complaint. On our system, if you have an electoral challenge after the results, you have to submit a complaint to the Elections Commission within 7 days. They brought the complaint that, you know, the elections were fraudulent, the elections were this and that, and you know. So our job was to sit and investigate the complaints. What are they talking about? What is the evidence? You know, so we went through that, went through the evidence, and we found out that the allegations, you know, there's no election that would not have irregularities, some form of irregularities. But, you know, to say that premeditated fraud and this and that, you know, that was far-fetched. With hundreds of national and international observers on the ground at every polling pool, we had about 3,000 of those polls around the country. So they were covered by all of the observers, national and international. And everybody saw the elections as being the freest and fairest for since the founding of our nation. In fact, I went to one polling center after in the night I was going home, and I just thought I should stop and see what's going on, you know, at the city hall. And when I was so pleased to see President Carter and his wife, they were there observing that particular center, you know. So, you know, I said, but what, how can somebody say, you know, that it means that you don't give credit to people? Because these are people, you know, internationally renowned people. They for instance, they were there at that particular pool. And while I stood there, I think I was there for about 5 or 10 minutes and I left, you know. Yeah. So I said, well, it's good. All these people are here, you know, things will be fine. So that's how the elections went, and President Sirleaf won. And people what we can see, you know. I think our country is moving in the right direction. I think we are about to turn the corner. We no longer can be considered a failed state. You know, I think we've come a long way. We've come a long way. Okay, if you want me to stop there for National Elections Commission, then I go to the next.
Sure.
If you have questions on National Elections Commission, fine.
Can I just ask to go back to an earlier point that you made at the beginning of our discussion about the state of the Election Commission when you became chair?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm curious if you could maybe describe a little bit more about what the Election Commission looked like at the time.
The Elections Commission, for instance, had the 1985 elections law provided for five commissioners, right? When I got to the commission, when we were pushing the 2003 elections, there were activists, civil society, and other people, political parties, politicians were agitating for a reconstitution of the election commission as it was. So there were people, you know, so it's rather than reconstituting or restructuring the elections commission at that time, what President Taylor did was to simply add two persons to the commission. He didn't touch the five commissioners that people had a problem with, but he simply added two more, and that was it. And so the commission from five, it went to seven, and today it is still seven members. Then there were, you know, a lot of people, in my view, you know, I felt that because you cannot be a partisan to serve on an election commission. But there were a lot of people who were obviously, you know, ruling party people all over the place. So what we had to do, in fact, we had to dismiss, you know, 100 plus persons, you know, to be able to, you know, assess and recruit more people. You know, we ask them if you have the qualification. We set new qualification criteria for serving as election worker. And we ask them if you meet this qualification, you may apply, you know. You may apply. But we cannot conduct elections as we are expected to do with the current composition of this commission. We had to do a lot of internal, you know, changes, restructuring, and things to make sure that everyone was comfortable with the commission. You must not be a member of any political party if you are going to serve as, in our system, if you are going to serve as an election worker or election commissioner. And if you are upon appointment, you have to resign.
Can I just ask on the question of vetting the staff that you were hiring?
Yeah.
How would you be able to sort of tell if somebody was a political worker, or I guess the broader question is, what are some of the criteria then that went into the vetting?
We had people who asked people to apply, and there were interviews conducted. We didn't just pick people and bring them. In fact, UNMIL at the time, the United Nations Mission in Liberia, they practically, you know, supervised that whole process of recruiting new staffers for the commission. And there were guidelines, there were qualification criteria. And then basically, you know, we had to bring new people, election supervisors, poll workers, and all of these people. So, and they were paid incidentally by, you know, the poll workers, that is, the poll workers were paid by UNMIL actually. And for us, we brought people because, for instance, there were some people in positions who didn't have the requisite qualification. For instance, the controller that I said, no, but you cannot be in school and be a controller of this kind of important institution. You got to have at least a first degree. And we had to, you know, let him go. And I didn't let him go, but we demoted him. At least maybe an accounting assistant, accountant, or something like that. But to be chief, to be the controller, you know, you don't have the qualification. But that's how the system was being. And incidentally, he left, He left because he didn't want to be demoted, and then he went and joined the elections for his county. And today he's senator for his county. So, after elections, when I was going for confirmation, I said, wow, this is going to stare me in the face. But unfortunately, it did not, So, but issues, that we have to deal with, issues of integrity,
Was the prospect of violence breaking out in the election campaign period and on election day itself a major concern of yours?
We really did not have any violence per se, What I call it was just a euphoria, people were so just excited and, I think the campaign went fairly well without any major incident, there were verbal clashes, but nobody hit somebody or, people would say things to each other. That kind of propaganda, whatever. But there were no actual violence, It was after the elections that, there was a threat of violence. Because, like I said, the ambassador and his party felt that they were cheated. And so they went on the rampage, on the streets, blocking road, causing problems. And so the police had to engage them, the riot police, and at one point they want to march on the election commission premises, I remember one international worker, I think she was a PR, public relations person. They asked me, I was announcing the provisional results, and for the second round, and they knew that they were, tailing behind the incumbent. So they got violent and started in the streets, doing all kinds of things. And so this lady asked me, do you still want to continue giving the results? I said, why not? I said, just the results that reflect the will of the people. We got to. I don't care about violence. Unless you are going to say that you can protect me, you need to deploy on me. But we have to give the result. This is what the people have said. The voices of the people, I don't care if anybody doesn't like it and they want to, be violent. But I can't stop giving the announcement. So at some time, people try to, disrupt and, still fear in people and all that. And I said, no, this is not something we are making up. This is what came from the field. We got to announce it,
During that period after the election when there was this challenge, did you feel that you were able to do anything like, for instance, announce the results quickly or back up the results with election observer reports to try to lessen the chance for there to be more violence?
No, there was no time that we tried to, compromise or defer anything. We went strictly according to the timetable. Mm-hmm. Irrespective of what we were doing outside our building, we were focused, we were doing what we had to do. Mm-hmm. There was no time. This lady would have wanted for us to maybe suspend it, but I said, no, we can't do that. This is the result. There are remedies on our law. If you don't like the results, at the end, you have filed a challenge, and it will be investigated. If we investigate and you don't like what our decision is, then you can go to the Supreme Court. That is the law. But we cannot come here and stop the result because somebody is out there picketing and unhappy about something, Yeah, so.
May I ask one final question on elections, and then maybe we can just transition a bit? I'm curious, just looking back on your time as the chair of the Elections Commission, if there were one or two things you wish you had been able to do as chair, but you were in some way prevented from doing or unable to do or constrained, that you think would have perhaps had a greater effect on the successful outcome of the elections?
Let's see, what is it? I can't remember anything. There were some distractions. There was a time, for instance, that one of our election provisions were challenged. People said that all my life, since I've been hearing about elections, I know that every voter has one vote. Suddenly, somebody introduces something and say, for senatorial election, people must vote twice. And that was disturbing. And they went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court honored that particular petition and gave people the opportunity to vote when they go to the election for the senatorial election, vote twice. You know, check two names. And I said, well, this is very strange to our practice, to our democracy. I've never seen this before. The rationale for, according to them, was that because every county has two, is entitled to two senators. So why should a person just vote for one? People should be able to take two. I said, no, but you know, it leaves the choice to the people. The person I may vote for, the candidate, may not be the same one that you will vote for. So when, what if there's a tie by voting twice for, you know, what? I said, I don't think so. I think we are, you know, complicating this process. But the Supreme Court spoke, and so we had to go along. But that was very, you know, it was very disturbing to me. I didn't understand where that came from.
Thank you for that.
So where did you transition from the National Election Commission?
From the National Elections Commission, I went to Ministry of Justice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you want to talk about that now?
Yeah. How did you come to take that post?
Well, I was appointed by the president, of course. I was nominated by her, confirmed by the Senate after a long period. I think that must have been the longest confirmation process. I left the elections. The elections inauguration were held January 16, I think. I was nominated, I think, in February or so. I didn't get confirmed until, I think, May or almost June, something like that. You know, it was up and down. People were, you know, kicking against my confirmation. So, but from the National Elections Commission, I was nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate after a long time, and then appointed by her in 2006, I think May, June, something like that.
How would you characterize your role as it pertained to the police?
As a what?
As it pertained to the police.
During that Ministry of Justice time?
Yeah.
Oh, those were difficult times. In fact, the police were in the process of being restructured, you know. That was part of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, the CPA, in 2003, August, that came out of Accra. They said they needed to restructure the police, restructure the army, and so those were difficult times. The police, many of them felt, you are coming from out of war, and people think that, you know, you are putting in processes to deprive them of their jobs, and you know, how are they going to rebuild their lives? It was really a difficult and emotional time for many of them. So some people they could not refuse because this was part of the peace process. They had to get rid of the old hands, and personally, I felt that some of the the people, the process, it was not in the best interest. It was counterproductive to what we were trying to build. We're trying to rebuild law and order, the rule of law. And to set people who had experience, who have worked in the system and they had experience, more mature people, excuse me. And and put them down and bring particularly people who have been fighting war, ex-rebels. I don't think it was a wise thing. We agreed there was need for restructuring, but on the scale at which it was done, just about this, disbanding all of the mature, experienced people and bringing in youngsters people who had come from war, you know, and had, you know, the mentality of violence. I thought that was it was not the best thing to have done, my candid opinion. But the Ministry of Justice was a very challenging task because people had come, just come from war. People were, you know, just violence prone, taking the law into their own hands. Yeah, so as I was saying, you know, the my time at the Ministry of Justice was at a very challenging time. We had just ended the war. People were used to taking the law into their own hands, and the court system was not yet fully functional. And so there were a lot of mob justice. People would burn people just like that, put tire on them and burn them. And a lot of jungle justice was there. We were threatened with demonstrations, protests, violent ones from the ex-soldiers who said that they should not have been demobilized in the first place. So there were constant agitations, protests, demonstrations. At one time, we had to arrest and charge some of these people and send them to court. It was only through the intervention of the president, which he said, you know, drop the charges and, you know, let's talk then. But it was really bad, you know, at times. We needed to rebuild the legal system. Lack of lawyers, lack of qualified magistrates in most of the areas. In one of the counties, there were hardly any law school graduates serving as magistrates, as the law requires for the stipendiary magistrate. He or she must be a law school graduate. We had none of that, I think, except for one county. So we had to put all this in place. We built the system, we staffed and re-equip the various police depots, the magistrates areas, bring in lawyers to prosecute cases of corruption and other things. And it was that kind of that was the environment we came into. And so it was very, 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 very tasking, very challenging to be at the Ministry of Justice at that time. I remember one time I was almost kidnapped because the ex-soldiers had again started rioting and decided that, you know, for one reason or the other, either the demand of pay or something, compensation, and they blockaded the street. The ELWA junction, if you all know what I'm talking about. But when you are coming from Barbados International Airport, you enter in the city, so they blocked that area, and nobody could go, nobody could come. You know, it was tense. And so I had to go to see what was going on. And when I went, I met the soldiers, the leaders, some of the leaders, because they told me that when I decided to engage them, they say, oh, we are not the leaders, our leaders are leaders. Because they have actually put a line. We couldn't cross, or they couldn't, you know. So I said to them, what is the problem, gentlemen? You know, yeah, we can't continue this. The war is over. The war is over. What we are doing now, we are back into civilian rule. You cannot, you know, infringe upon the rights of other people. You are infringing upon the right of movement of the other people. Look at this case, they are coming from school and you say they cannot go home because you blocked the road. So, you know, can you remove the blockade so that we can maybe come to the office, we can talk about, you know, what your demands are, what your grievances are. But then the National Security Advisor had gone there, and they said they would not listen to him. So So he left. So I was called, and I went there to try to negotiate. So when I was just about to cross the line, because they are blocked us, you know, the police, the inspector general at the time, came and grabbed me by the arm and said, "Come back." I said, "I'm happy, I'm going to talk to them." She said, "Do you know what they are planning? They want to kidnap you." So I said, "Yeah." She said, "Yes." So she got me back to the car. I said, "Don't go there." Because they were really serious, you know. They really meant to do some real serious thing there that day. So, but this is the kind of a thing we have to deal with. You know, you have to calm ex-soldiers. Ex-soldiers can be dangerous. To calm them so that they don't go and, you know, do any further damage. And so he said to me, "If you want to talk, you have to come. Let's go on our side. Our bosses are there." So I was going. That's when the police director got there on time, you know, and said, "No, oh, you know, the plan is they're going to kidnap you." You know. So all these incidents were what we had to deal with: mob justice, police issues, demonstration, as soldiers every night. There was a threat to the security of the state at that time. It was very fragile, very volatile at the time with these people. Every day was making demand for one thing or the other, you know, charging government with this and that. So that's the kind of thing. With this, we had to do some indictments at the time for the former head of state, Charles Judy Bryant, on corruption charges, because the ECOWAS had commissioned an audit, and the audit of the ECOWAS financial investigators implicated him. And so, because the president said that she would fight corruption, when she came, we took, those were, you know, some of the first cases, corruption cases that we took, including AIDS and other people. I had to go personally into the grand jury, you know, to make a case that Liberia was trying to move, you know, to a better position in the, you know, everyone was fighting corruption. We needed to fight corruption and to tell them what the effects of corruption were, you know, low pay, low roads, no water, no electricity. We needed to rebuild this. And we had corruption, people perpetrating corruption and getting away, then we would not experience development and progress. You know, gave them vivid examples in the jury room there, in the grand jury room, because it was kind of proving to be difficult to have the indictment room. So I said, "Well, I'll go in there and talk to them. You know, we have the evidence. This is not our investigation. This is the ECOWAS investigators report. This is what it says. So we need to prosecute, you know." So we had him indicted, and then of course the public is never happy. "Oh, why he? Why not the others? Why?" So it was just, you know, they are doing selective prosecution. They're doing, you know. In this game, I guess, you damn if you do and you damn if you don't. So, you know, that's the experience. Even here, it's the same thing. Even here, it's the same thing.
Did you see the police progress during your tenure?
Well, that was still early. It was just still early. They were still trying to, you know. But I think if anything, they got a message that the police was no longer going to be used as a terror machinery. It was going to be pro-people, you know, people-friendly, and there was going to be no more torture in investigations, you know. Those kind of old practices, we had to send a message that, you know, this time was different. The reputation of the police had to be cleaned up, you know.
it was no longer a police force charged with protecting only the powers that be, but it had to protect the people, it had to protect property, it had to protect everyone. So when somebody is charged, they are presumed innocent until they are tried and convicted or acquitted, as the case may be. So you don't use the same tactics, torture, you know, as we saw during the past regime, during the 10 past regime. You know.
Do you think the police took that message to heart? Did you see it in their behavior?
Well, I think, you know, some progress has been made. It's not as rampant as it used to be. Because before, once you were accused, and police went for you, they almost, you know, sentenced you before you even were investigated or tried. So, but these days, it's not like that. The police know that you gotta respect the accused's rights. You do your investigation, and we're not having any more preventive detentions. If you bring somebody, charge them, you accuse someone, you must charge them within the time frame, 48 hours. If you need that time, because most time they believe that when the law says that the accused must be charged within 48 hours, they believe that even if they have to charge them, they must wait for 48 hours. That's not it. In case you need more than, you know, 24 hours, you have up to 48 hours. But they think that they must use it 48 hours, even if they know what they are going to charge the person with. And I said, no. So I think these things are getting clearer to them.
Were you able to punish bad behavior in the police? Were you able to enforce a level of discipline?
I can recall if there were any particular case, any example of misconduct that was. I know there was an incident where the president had to suspend the inspector general because she went overboard, you know, her function. I think it had to do with the Port Authority, National Port Authority, and the Liberia Seaport Police, LSP. They had some issues, some, you know, in connection with police had suspected that some people had either done something, and she moved in there, and, you know, used excess power or something like that, and the president had to, you know, step in and impose some sanctions. I remember.
Did you have confidence in the IG during your tenure?
During my tenure?
Yeah, did you have confidence in the IG?
Yeah, I did. In fact, I was pleased that she was appointed IG because she had been very active a police officer during the, as far back as 1979, when we had the Organization of African Unity Conference here for the first time. And we remember we admired her so much. She was on a motorbike, and we had not seen a woman, you know. Yeah. And so we used to cheer her. We used to, you know, she was tough. And so when I heard that, you know, she was appointed, I was pleased. And we went together well, fairly well, you know.
Hello, Laura.
Sure. So has it moved to your current position as chairperson of the, unless you had any more. So, do you
want
to talk about that transition to the LACC?
Yeah, okay. After Ministry of Justice, I went to Commerce Ministry before coming here.
Yes.
But okay, from the Ministry of Justice, I moved on to the Ministry of Commerce. And that, I
I was really not too familiar with the economics and, you know. But I remember there were times, you know, those were times when the global financial crisis, on the outset of the global financial crisis, and of course affected commodities and things, rice shortage and all of that. And it was very, very, you know, challenging. But we tried to make sure that we kept rice in the market, even if the prices have been high. But we were the best in the West African sub-region as far as price was concerned during those crises. So at least I can say that, not being an economist, but I was able to keep the food on the table, you know. Yeah, and we were able to survive the crisis. Just to say a few words on that. And from there, from the Commerce Ministry, then I'm now here at the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission. And the task here is to investigate, prosecute, and prevent acts of corruption.
And to what extent do you feel that the LACC has fulfilled its legal mandate to this point?
Well, as much as this assignment is a tall order, but I think we are doing our best. We are executing our mandate. We are investigating cases of corruption. We have recommended for prosecution to the Ministry of Justice several cases because the law requires that we prosecute in coordination with them. Except where they fail to prosecute within 90 days, then we may go to prosecution. At this point, we have not been able to take cases to court ourselves because our legal department has not yet been activated. We have not yet gotten the resources to hire lawyers to go to court on our own. But I think that this budget, the next budget year, which begins July 1, will give us some resources for us to hire our own lawyers, and I can see that we will be going to court in the not too distant future. So as far as investigation is concerned, we are doing what we have to do. We are also creating awareness as the law requires, to prevent acts of corruption. We have launched and executed a public awareness campaign in our 15 political subdivisions. We just concluded that a few days ago. We've also, my office and I have been engaged with students, university students, high school students. I've been going there. I think we've done about a dozen schools by now, talking to the students about what corruption is, how corruption affects them, and how they also have a responsibility to join the fight against corruption. And I tell them what corruption, in their setting, what it means. If you spy, if you exchange sex for grace, if you, you know, buy. I mean, these things that people can do in the schools. They're kind of corruption. Mm-hmm. So we tell them that it is not just public corruption, but even in your schools, there's corruption as well, and so you need to guard yourself against it. So we've done that with the schools, the communities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned not having a legal department. What other things constrain this mandate, or what are other obstacles that you have?
Okay, we don't have lawyers to prosecute, but we also don't have the full cooperation of all of the stakeholders in this fight against corruption. You know, you have, for instance, what we try to do as a preventive measure. We introduce an assets declaration regime, assets, liabilities, and income declaration. Mm-hmm. Some of government officials, mostly in the executive branch, have complied. The judiciary, the legislature have not complied. So, you know, the motivation, the support in the fight, I don't think we have the sense that it's not really, has not really been embraced by all of the stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And so that is a constraint. If people are not willing to support the fight against corruption, you know, then the political world is lacking, it can be difficult. We've not been able to actually send clear messages to prosecution and convictions of corrupt officials, you know. But yeah, there have been some convictions, but you know, the ones that will send a signal down to the man, you know, that if that person can be, then I myself. That kind of thing has not yet happened, and we need to do that. We need to set that example. Mm-hmm. We need to, you know, so that this fight can really succeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you say are some of the pivotal moments in the history of the LACC?
The LACC? Well, you know, we pivotal moments. We, for instance, when we issue our releases, recommending prosecution of certain officials, like the Ministry of Finance, when we requested that the Controller General, the former Controller General, be prosecuted along with some officials in that government, in that ministry. When we also issued recommendation to the Ministry of Justice requesting for the prosecution of the former Inspector General of Police for her role in a particular transaction with a certain businessman, you know. And but unfortunately, those cases have not been picked up. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the constraints, you know. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the constraints.
And in your opinion, what do you believe the LACC has done particularly well?
Well, I think we've been, our investigations, we have not been, we do not differentiate, we do not discriminate. Anybody who case come here, anybody who we cite them, and if come, lawmakers have been here to give, you know, information that they may have in certain cases. We cite any and everybody who, you know, is accused from any complaints or reports. We do not discriminate. And there was a time that we even had to issue a statement to say that, you know, it was not appropriate for the president to say that certain indictees, audit indictees, were, you know, were people that she had confidence in. And we said that we think that they should be left to those people to go and clear their own names and, you know, reestablish their integrity. Because that kind of a statement coming from the highest office, it would undermine our jobs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, those things, we did that, and that took Kerry, was widely publicized, and some people did not like it.
And what do you believe would facilitate or improve the performance of LACC? You mentioned judicial and legislative cooperation. Anything else?
Well, and also the support, the material and financial support, mm-hmm. is lacking. The financial support is lacking. Since this commission was established nearly 3 years ago, our initial budget we asked for to build the institution was 3.8 million. Today we have never even received 2 million yet. Oh. After 3 years, we have not yet received 2 million. So it shows that, you know, the support is lacking. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I could ask just a more final general question, I'm curious, I believe that the LACC was born out of GMAP as sort of an anti-corruption measure, and I'm curious how you feel GMAP did as a whole in rooting out corruption.
Well, LACC was not actually created out of the GMAP experience. The mm-hmm. LACC, as part of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption,
okay.
And we have ratified those conventions, the AU Convention, so we were obliged to establish the Anti-Corruption Commission mm-hmm. as required by those conventions. GMAP, yeah, I think GMAP did, you know, fairly good job. Not perfect, but they at least they tried to put in place a system of you know, accountability. And to the extent that that, you know, happened, I think they did well. They did well. Everybody knows now that there's a system to be followed in financial transactions. There's a reporting channel that, you know, so they brought that consciousness about accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think at the level at which resources were being siphoned, you know, I think that put a check to it a bit. Put a check to it.
Do you have any more questions?
What's the GMAP controllers and advisors left in 2009, 2010? Do you think the improvements that they made, the checks on the opportunities for corruption, were those sustained, or did some of the old habits come back?
Well, I don't work at the Ministry of Finance, and so I wouldn't know whether they sustained. But what I can say, what I have noticed is that, you know, there's corruption still. There's still corruption. There's still corruption. And but people who perpetuate corruption, they always find ways to beat the system. You know, no matter how many reforms you put in place, people are clever and they will beat the system. So, you know, GMAP did its part, yes. They did well. They at least brought about the consciousness, the system. But it has not stopped corruption. Corruption is still, you know, pretty well, you know, pretty much alive and well.
Chair Johns Morris, we've taken a lot of your time. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we stop the recording today?
I just to say a thing, thank you for coming to hear my story, my perspectives on our sojourn from war to peace, from conflict to peace, and the roles that I have played. You know, I hope that will be helpful, useful, you know.
You've played a lot of leadership roles, and we thank you for your insights.
Thank you.